The Grade Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a grade cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the grade cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks, champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to the Grey Cricketer podcast on Fox Sports. It's that time again. The cricket's back. It feels like it's been gone forever, but it's back. Perth starts, well, this morning as you're listening to it, as this is being recorded on a Wednesday night. It's a big show and mainly surrounding the guest appearance of Michael Atherton, the most storied cricketer we possibly will ever get on this podcast. And I just want to say, just want to preface it, that I know that when you download this podcast, it just seems like, oh yeah, the Grey Cricketer boys just got Michael Atherton, and that's just easy. It's actually really amazing for us to be able to speak to these people. I'm just still blown away by it that we get to speak to him, but that's coming a little bit later. Adam Collins, of course, on the show as well to talk about the Marsh situation, the Hanscom situation, the press conference today, and the sledging and drinking culture. I suppose we'll start, chaps, by saying my name. My name's Ian Higgins. I'm joined by Sam Perry and Dave Edwards. I just forgot to say that. But let's talk about Perth tomorrow, boys. What are we expecting? Third test match.
Well, g'day, Higos, and whatever we are expecting, I'm sure we'll be wrong by the time people listen to this show. But yeah, Perth throws up just the formula conversation, doesn't it? There's always one Marsh or a couple of them playing. There's always a couple of front page spreads of WA players, and if you're from the Eastern Seaboard, everything just looks really bright when you watch it. There's about 3 days of conversations about how fast the track is when it's not anymore. But the ball still does seem to fly through to the keeper and drive centre, sort of, you know, you get value for shots. I don't know. I'm just trying to do sort of whack a bingo. There'll be about 30,000 shots over to the Harness racetrack on Channel 9 as well.
You've hit all the whacker KPIs there, Pez, already. I'm just expecting, a lightning-fast, hard wicket, steepling, Kirtley Ambrose-style bounce in 1995. And I think the Australians are too. I mean, we all are, and we're talking about it right now, which is weird because the whacker hasn't been fast for years. It's almost like Malcolm Gladwell needs to do an episode of revisionist history on the myth of the whacker pitch. I'd really love to listen to that.
Almost.
Next amazing guest. Reference, early doors. I think what's funny, boys, to sort of add to the you know, the stereotypical lexicon is now saying like the whacker's not as quick as it used to be. Like that's actually now a thing that people say. But we will obviously see Jeff Thompson bowling and Rod Marsh standing, you know, at the sight screen. I suppose the biggest news from the Australian camp, chaps, is that Mitchell Marsh looks like, as we record on Wednesday evening, I keep saying that, it looks like Mitch Marsh is going to come into the side to bat six and Pete Hanscom is going to be out of the team. What do we make of this selection? We spoke last week, Dave, especially about that's one of the joys about Sean Marsh scoring runs, that he now gets to play cricket with his brother.
And there's no doubt that it's a reward for his brother as well. But, I mean, Hanscom's just suffering from looking bad, isn't he? You know, there's been plenty of guys who failed three times with the bat and made scores around the sort of 10s, 20s and 30s who've retained their place. Some of them are recalled very, very often to the side as well. But Hanscom looks bad. He's had his technique dissected from various people and he's been unceremoniously shunted back to the Big Bash League, where he won't play four-day cricket for a while. Not to, you know, forget that three tests ago he played one of the innings of his life. You know, in Bangladesh, he's a great player of spin. He's always been one of the boys. Everything looks really good for Hanscom, but he's got an unwieldy technique and he's gone. I mean, just remember, always look good.
Always look good. I mean, you just said, like, he still is averaging 47. So kind of, if you use like a sales analogy, he's still hitting his annual target. But like recently, he's had a couple of dry months. So I think obviously runs are the only currency in cricket, right? And Hanscom needed runs. He needed near-term runs desperately. He needs to hit his numbers. Otherwise, we'll look at his technique. We'll look at him and how he looks and find that as a reason to get rid of him. You know, some companies accept the sales guy who's always around the office and turns up late, you know, jokes around. He plays a lot of golf with clients and he's the worst bloke ever. But it doesn't matter because he's hitting his numbers. Nothing matters if you're hitting your numbers, and Hanscom just isn't hitting those numbers.
But some numbers, Dave, are more valuable than others in Australian cricket, aren't they? So I just wanted to ask whether Hanscom was more like kind of cryptocurrency, Bitcoin. Yeah. We're not really sure exactly whether the numbers are actually worth anything. They look bad. They look scary from the outside. And Hanscom's technique does look scary. He's deep in the crease. He hits his bat to the deck like Ejaz Ahmed did. Pretty good player. Ejaz, you know, he doesn't get on the front stool, on the front dog very often. Mm. And, you know, he hasn't hit numbers sort of for two games and he's gone.
I saw that Smith was actually quoted as saying that a recall for Mitch Marsh would say more about the whacker pitch than Peter Hanscom's batting. And I just like how Steve Smith diminished both players with that sentence. Basically, at the end of the day, it comes down to the wicket. These blokes mean nothing.
So Hanscom seems to be on the receiving end of like what's now known as opposite of Sean Marsh syndrome. I'll come up with a catchy name for that later, but for now that's what it's going to be called. So Sean Marsh was in the team for looking good, and Pete Hanscom, doesn't he look bad at the moment? and I've got to say from this time that I actually don't mind this selection, because I've got to say Hanscom does look to be in some real bad nick, doesn't he? Like, he doesn't look like he's in good nick. And I think I actually watched Steve Smith's press conference today because I'm a 31-year-old lonely man. And he said, I think it seemed to me he was really scarred by the Australia-New Zealand test match a couple of years ago, where it was just the worst wicket in the world, and I think they need more bowlers. But at the same time, we keep hearing about how this is the best bowling attack in the world, but they're still looking for fucking Flint off 05, aren't they? They're still looking for him. And anytime Mitch Marsh is in the runs, he's in the wickets, just
do everything. Do everything and make us win. One bloke.
Yep. I mean, it's just the same conversation about Mitchell Marsh as well, isn't it? It's like people are sort of suggesting that he's actually come back a more obstinate player. I mean, there are no numbers to back up Mitchell Marsh being a better player than he was beforehand. I'm not against him. I like the idea of Mitchell Marsh. It's just that there are some players who don't have to do very much to get selected because they look good, and others have to do double. You know, Peter Hanscom will have to score a couple of double tons to reconvince people that he can still play. And, you know, the idea that, like, well, didn't he look bad? It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. He looked bad when he scored 100 for Australia. His technique just looks bad. But now that he's got out a few times with it, it's sort of like, you know, well, he's clearly out of nick.
I just don't understand how, like, a sport which is so defined by numbers, the selectors can pick a bloke who averages 22 and can bowl a bit of seam up over a guy who averages 47. I'm sorry, but those numbers just don't add up.
Because his brother did well last week. It reminded me last week, actually, I think it was you, Pez, who was saying this, but like, when Steve Smith's eyes go, it's going to look bad. And I just couldn't help but think when I was watching Pete Hanscom in the last test match of Adelaide that he looked like the end of Steve Smith's career.
He's only 21. He looked bad. He's already looking...
I thought as excellent as Jimmy Anderson's spell in the second innings was in Adelaide, where he was bowling round the wicket outswing to Steve Smith, gave like a little indication of what Steve Smith looks like when he's in trouble. And it's so unfair to harp on about Steve Smith looking bad in 10 years.
Nah, do it.
Because obviously he's a great player, all of those kind of qualifiers. But he really did give a little glimpse. Just to extend this idea a little bit as well, all of a sudden we're talking about having three fast bowlers that bowl at 90 miles an hour. Like, I always thought Hazelwood was in more of the McGrath category, but apparently he's pushing up above 140s now. Don't you think, like, wasn't it great watching Glenn McGrath in his last two or three years where it was sort of like 128 kilometres an hour? Do you think Hazelwood would be that when he's sort of 32, 33?
I liked McGrath with a little bit of Gilchrist up to the stumps too. That was very rare. I don't know if that'll happen for Hazelwood in this modern era. But, he was the McGrath clone, wasn't he? And we've always enjoyed a McGrath clone. There was Stuart Clarke as well.
Always.
McGrath clone. We'd always liked cloning McGrath. But he's kind of strayed away from that, hasn't he? Now he's a firebrand. He's part of this three-pronged pace attack. And, God, don't we like saying that phrase.
But Hazelwood bowled a ball in the last test match which was 148 kilometres an hour.
I'll never forget it.
That is legitimately rapid. Like, I was the same as you, Pez. I thought he was high 130s, that kind of thing. But at the same time, I still think that, like, the parkies out there, are they even saying parkies?
Yeah,
I apologise. Yeah, you can edit that out. That's shocking.
But it's just like, I think people underestimate how quick 120 k's an hour actually is. You know, like when you like some bloke, you know, it's an awful cricketer who's bowling halfway decent. They go, oh, what if he's bowling like 130? Like, I don't think people realise how quick 125 is, let alone, you know, that kind of speed.
I never had my speed measured as an adult bowler, but I remember going to the TAP camp at Narrabeen at like the age of 12 or 13 and getting my speed measured, and I was bowling 104 kilometres an hour. And there was a guy who, rep player. And there was another guy who, and he was lightning, and he was the same age as me, and he bowled 110, and he was frightening at that age. So I just, I cannot even fathom. I mean, I've stood behind the nets, you know, at the test matches and watched, you know, Stark, Johnson, etc. But just coming up against 140, 150 is just a different level.
Yeah, it's funny actually watching the cricket over here in London, because the emphasis on pace is just so like minimal compared to Australia. Firstly, it's hard to make the conversion with miles an hour to kilometres an hour. Kilometres an hour is so much more specific.
Real quick in your head.
But also, you know, in Australia, when you watch the cricket, there's like a speed gun on every second ball. It doesn't happen much on BT Sport here in the UK. I don't know if that's a good or bad thing.
So somehow we have managed to trap ourselves into a conversation about speed, you know, given that the Wacker will not provide that. Maybe a little bit more bounce than that, than the average test wicket around the world, you know, say in Abu Dhabi or something like that. But let's talk about probably the biggest story in the last few days. It's sort of died down a little bit, but the whole Ben Duckett thing has been and gone, and it sort of happens within the time frames of the last two podcasts, between the Butcher podcast and the Atherton podcast. That's a funny sentence. Ben Duckett poured a beer over a teammate's head, and now he's not playing. And I note that Ben Stokes and Alex Hale, who knocked a bloke out, are now in the ODI squad. So the rules never apply to the best players. Like, come to training unless you're good, and then you don't have to.
Well, I mean, the good thing for Duckett is now I know who he is. I mean, that's good for him. Seriously. Honestly, pouring beer over a guy's head, fucking wars have been started over less than that. And like, they've tried to brush this off, the ECB, et cetera, as nothing serious. But it's not innocuous to pour a beer over someone's head in public. I mean, I've never done it, nor has it ever happened to me. But I think to do such a thing, you've got to seriously consider the implications. And pouring beer over a bloke's head, what's that going to do with his salad? It's going to be terrible on his salad. It's going to ruin his ability to circuit. He might have to go to the bathroom and blow dry his Mark's shirt. It's just going to ruin his night. It's the second worst thing he can do after belting a bloke in Bristol on CCTV.
And it's not like a crime. I refuse to accept it's this sort of like heat of the moment crime of passion either, because if you actually, you know, do the forensics on it, and I have, Duckett's a shortish kind of bloke. Anderson's quite a tall bloke. So if Duckett wants to, you know, and this is the verb that I enjoyed them using, douse Anderson in beer, because it's flammable. You would surely kind of push it towards his chest, you know, if you're presuming they're front on. But Duckett's actually had to get his arm up and over Anderson's head and turn it over. So it's quite a deliberate act. I want to know how much beer was in there, etc. You know, there's a lot of questions to be asked. It can't be seen to be a small thing.
No.
It's like the magic bullet theory from the JFK assassination. Yeah,
exactly like that.
You know, it's just
deconstructed.
Yeah.
I mean, so much talk over the English culture. I mean, what about the Australian culture? Like, does Australia circuit anymore? Or are we... or are we quietly circuiting? Like, are we picking our spots carefully? Because all we're hearing about is the English circuit. Like, are we doing in-house circuiting as opposed to being out in public areas where things can and do go wrong?
Yeah, and to add some further questions to this, I mean, this has all been about perpetuating stereotypes, but that is one stereotype that is not going forward. I thought Australians were the drinkers. And is there any part of us where we're talking about three-pronged pace attacks, you know, speed, alphadom, sledging, going too far with sledging on the field? That's one part that's kind of missing from the Australian triumvirate of stereotypes. Where's our drinking? And should we be nervous about the fact that we haven't had an indiscretion?
I think, I'm very nervous, Sam, about this. And in many ways, I think that England are therefore winning the Ashes. It feels like England are winning the Ashes. I mean, they're having a way better time.
Great time, aren't they?
Blokes headbutting other blokes, pouring beers on their head, you know, like a bit of a scuffle on the street, you know, in Bristol. England are having a fucking ripping time.
He goes, I heard that they're ordering trays of shots as well. Like Michael Vaughan said that when these guys go out, they're like uni students and they're actually ordering shots. Like that is proper going out. Like that scary canary scuba kind of going out in Sydney.
Yeah, and like the worrying thing is that, like, you know, before I think Dave Warner seemed to be like the biggest circuiter, you know, had that reputation. But that, you know, he's like turned himself into like this you know Australian father of the year, and he's nicknamed the
sports
Reverend,
dad of the year.
He's like he's all into his fitness now, and like,
sorry, I just wanted to clarify that he was the sports dad of the year, not the Australian of the year or the Australian father of the year.
No, sorry, I apologize.
Just to clarify,
that's my mistake.
Well, the sports commission will be happy that you've made that clarification. Yeah.
But like, yeah, so like the Australian cricket team's just become like a, you know, an Instagram fitness influencer, and England a uni lad.
I don't like the way it's going. Yeah, lad Australia Bible. Is Fitspo, England is Lad Bible. It's not right.
Yeah. Good Facebook page.
All right. Well, so. I mean, there is other cricket happening in the world. I just want to touch on a couple of things really quickly. So New Zealand and West Indies played in the Test Series. New Zealand absolutely dicked the West Indies, fair to say, 2-0 in a 2-Test Series. I want to touch on possibly the worst start to a Test career ever, and his name is... His name is Sunil Ambriss, who has had 4 innings at the test level. He's kicked his stumps over twice, hit wicket, and he's in his 4th innings, he was on 4 not out, and he had to retire hurt with a fractured forearm. So 4 test innings, 2 hit wicket, 1 retired hurt. Have you heard of a worse start to a test career?
No, not really. I mean, it doesn't get more embarrassing than being hit wicket, I think, especially early in your career, because really being dismissed hit wicket means that you've just wanted more time to see the ball. You've been given an allotted amount of time to see it, and you've just said, "Now, can I have a little bit more? Can I play off 23 yards or 24 yards? And, and then the stumps have gotten the way. So it's beta. It's beta dismissals. And then he got a broken fucking arm. So
I think in Australia, especially like when we were growing up, I remember like batting coaches always telling you to bat further outside your crease, like maybe like a foot or two outside your crease. And I always remember doing that, but also fearing that the ball would come to me too quickly and I get out, which happened a lot. But I did it because it was the alpha thing to do. Maybe he's doing the same thing.
I think this actually comes back to the Hanscom thing. I think ultimately he's being greatly discriminated against because of how deeply he bats in the crease. You know, when you had your Slaters, etc., batting a metre outside of the crease, the message was, I don't need the time that the pitch allows me. I can do it quicker. I'm coming to you. But Hanscom being so far back is like taking a metaphorical backward step. And that's why, upon 2 failures, he has been summarily dismissed from the side for Sean Marsh's brother.
So, at the opposite end of the spectrum, fellow West Indian Chris Gayle was playing in a 2020 match. He hit 100 and... Well, how many did he hit? 146 not out of 69 balls. He hit 18 sixes, so he scored over 100 of his runs in sixes. He was asked if he is the Bradman of T20 cricket. He said, no, I am better. So Chris Gayle has said that he is better than Bradman.
He said, I'm the greatest of all time, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yes, he did.
But did Bradman only hit 1-6 in his test career, didn't he? Like, Bradman was a risk-averse banker. Like, didn't he want to know what it was like to just bomb one and sit back and watch it sail in, like, a perfect parabola over the sight screen? Or maybe they didn't have sight screens back then. But I think there was just something suspicious about a bloke who values his wicket that highly. I'm just saying.
What do you suspect? What's the suspicion?
Something a bit off about a bloke who doesn't hit sixes. It's just all I'm saying.
And there's nothing off about Chris Gayle, though.
No, straight down the line. Good bloke.
Can I just say on that point, I know a lot of our listeners will like Chris Gayle. I just can't fucking cop him. I can't cop him. I don't know what I expect you guys to say to that. It's a no from me. Look, we've just spoken about circuiting just aside, and I want to tell you guys about Tom Blundell, who after his first test match, he's a debutant wicketkeeper filling in for BJ Watling. They won in the Basin Reserve against the West Indies, and he walked home from the Basin Reserve in his whites holding a stump. And the New Zealand team bus saw him and took a photo, and it's on their Twitter, and I actually retweeted it today, so you can see it on the Great Cricketers Twitter if you want to see it. That's just... How village is New Zealand?
Have you been to Wellington? Like, the walk around the Basin Reserve is just a lovely little stroll through suburbia. Like, I would have done the same thing. It's beautiful. Weird that he didn't get out of his whites, though. Obviously, no shower, no circuit.
Yeah.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, the test starts tomorrow. We're going to get Adam Collins on the line. That's the next voice you're going to hear. And then after that, the big one, Michael Atherton.
Meet Nugsy. As he orders a Dutch beer in a Japanese brothel, he checks his exclusively Australian My Cricket stats. But more on that contradiction later. Every morning he crawls out of his single bed in a global world, hungover as fuck, barely noticing his ciggies are German, his yellowing 93 Subaru is Japanese, and his favourite protein powder manufactured from the USA. He thinks nothing of chatting with Taiwanese women on OkCupid, while attempting to buy a new stick online with an overdrawn UK debit card, before getting caught up in yet another email phishing scam out of Nigeria. It hardly registers that he buys his $1 machine coffee from an American-Japanese convenience store, catching up on the cricket scores en route to meet his ex-wife at a solicitor's office in Chinatown. Unfortunately, the truly global nature of Nugsy's world only becomes apparent when he realises he's wasted his entire life savings on Australian-grade cricket. From rego fees to training kit, new sticks to post-match circuits. Not to mention a debilitating gambling addiction that has literally cost him everything. Lost everything to cricket? Might as well park some coin in a global managed fund that you don't really understand anyway. Columbus, the global investment experts.
Well, boys, we've got our man on the ground, Adam Collins. He's speaking to us from Perth. He's in the press box. I think he's in the Test Match Special press box, here to talk all things cricket, to bring the facts, to bring you things that we actually can't bring you. Collo, how are you?
G'day, fellas. Good to be back with you. I don't know about facts. Might give you a bit of fake news. Yes, I've pulled up in the Test Match Special box because I'll get yelled at if I'm in the press box talking shit to you guys for 10 minutes.
Mate, speaking...
I was hoping the Fremantle doctor could have added a bit of ambience to our conversation, but you've obviously got a nice soundproofed room, and kudos to you for that.
Yeah, I do. I was thinking about this before. It's the last time we'll have the Fremantle doctor. It's a bit, I don't know. I quite like the I quite like the whacker. I know I'm a bit of an outlier on this, but I think it's got its own beauty. Seeing excessively sunburnt fat people at the cricket's always a win for me. And I don't know. I think that the homogenised. You know, looking at it across the way now, just kneeling down to have a look at the new stadium, it's got this kind of like really elaborate brown wooden panelled. Boarding around the sides of it, and yeah, sure, it looks all modern and whatever else, but give me a couple of hills with no cover and grandstands built in the 80s any old time.
Well said. Such a vivid piece of imagery. Collo, you're there. You know, you've been following the cricket. You've been to Brisbane. You've been to Adelaide. This would have to be one of the biggest matches, at least in English, modern cricket history for England. You know, what's the sense? I mean, is Australia going to roll? Tell us what's going to happen. Is Australia going to roll over them go on a procession to a 5-0 win? Or, you know, are England a chance of hitting back there and squaring these ashes?
Well, the one thing I'd say about England is that they don't feel as though it's like 13-14. Joe Root went to great lengths today to say they felt shell-shocked 4 years ago after the first two test matches in Brisbane and Adelaide, and Johnson went mad. It doesn't have that same vibe to it, even just the way they've been gathering and training and all the rest. They seem fairly upbeat. So I'm not entirely sure they'll roll over. But it might not be a case of rolling over. I just don't think they have the cattle. I mean, I think the evidence of the first two test matches is that neither side are particularly good, but Australia have got more match winners. So that's going to be hard to overcome. They might make a tweak or two. I'm strongly of the view that Joe Root should elevate himself to number three. Traditionally, that's where your best player bats in Australia. Root's been reticent to do so, but yet the last time he batted three in a sustained stint was last summer in England when he made 250 against Pakistan when the ball was hooping around in Manchester. So, I mean, if he can do it there, I'm tipping he can do it on what will probably be a dead, lifeless, you know, shitty Perth track as it's been the last couple of years that, you know, that lends itself to batting big and batting long. Smith said today that 2 years ago when they played New Zealand here, it was impossible to get out if you're a batter after you got yourself in, and that feels like the time that Root should be, you know, should be capitalising on that rather than batting at four and exposing Vince. But I still get the sense that England will probably go in unchanged and sort of back what they've came with, but I'm not sure whether that'll be enough.
So I was going to ask you, Collo, if you were expecting any changes to the England side. I mean, you've sort of answered my question, but I suppose to follow that question up, I mean, given that Michael Phelps come Craig Overton played so well in the second test match, what was Jake Ball doing playing in the first test match? What was that about?
Man, all I can think of right now is Craig Overton smoking a massive bong like Phelps did up the Olympics a couple of years ago. Now I've got that image in my head. I think, and I'm not tipping that Overton's got some wonderful lung capacity as well, just on that point. I think that Overton wasn't picked in the first test because he was just not out of form, but it's a pecking order thing. And Ball was, by all reports, the star of the warm-up games. What little they are worth, by the way. How they are still persevering with warm-up games against Cricket Australia 11s. If I were the ECB, I'd retaliate next time when Australia go there and turn out a bunch of 14-year-olds under the guise of an ECB 11, because I'm not sure that the English side has got the sort of suitable practice. They used to come here to the Wacker after a tour game against the WA side in 98-99, I remember Matthew Nicholson like broke Nasser Hussain's face, and you know it was all quite brutal, and it was you know first string WA side. Now I don't know what you call that. Last weekend they played most of the side of the England Lions playing. They didn't bother turning out their main team, but I digress. I think Ball was the player earlier on in the tour they were pointing to as someone who could move the ball around a little bit, but he just struggled in Brisbane. And also, it's worth noting that Ball had to push back against plans that don't really suit his cricket. He plays at Trent Bridge. He pitches the ball up. He aims to, you know, get that traditional seamers line and length. At Brisbane, they were bowling a barrage of bounces most of the time at Smith to entice him into doing something stupid, which was never successful. So it didn't really reflect well upon him.
Yeah, Colo, and just on the other side of the camp with the Australians, I mean, we've already talked a bit about this on the podcast earlier with our own opinions, but it does look as if between Mitch Marsh and Hanscom that it's probably going to go Mitch Marsh's favour. Is that still kind of, I guess, the way it looks to be? And what are your kind of opinions on that? What's the rumblings in the press gallery?
It definitely feels that way. I mean, Smith today suggested that if it's hard, that it'd be hard to justify. If it's hard and flat, if it's hard and got a bit of life in it, I should say, then they might be able to get away with playing just the four bowlers if they're expecting to take 20 wickets a bit more straightforward a fashion. But if it is tacky and soft, and that's his concern, Smith said today that he's a bit worried that the pitch might be a little bit soft, that they'll need that extra bowler if it is lifeless. And if that's the case, Mitch Marsh will come in. And Hanscom will be going home in the proverbial body bag back to the BBL. So, and, you know, that's not always a bad thing for a young cricketer. We've seen, you know, many Australian players have to go back to domestic cricket and fill their boots a second time around. So that may work. But, I mean, it's a fairly significant fall from grace considering maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago you would have thought that Hanscom was roughly alongside Usman Khawaja in terms of seniority in the side, putting them both behind, if you like, Smith and Warner in that batting lineup. And now he's sort of the first man out with Shaun Marsh having done so well in Adelaide. So, yeah, it's interesting how quickly it turned for Hanscom, but I'm not sure it's sort of a terminal thing for him. I think it'll just be a case of waiting for conditions to suit until they're happy to go back to a lineup with six traditional batsmen. As for Marsh, I mean, you know, he looks so likely at domestic level. I remember a couple of hundreds he made in England 2 years ago in the warm-up games, pretty much got him in the side ahead of Shane Watson by the time they moved to Lords. He looks wonderful when he's hitting the ball hard. It's always been a question of whether his defence keeps up, especially against high-quality bowling. So that'll be the question for Marsh, whether he can get an opportunity to bat down at number six. If they're sort of 4 for 300, he'll likely cash in. But at 4 for 20, it could be a different story. But it doesn't look like these are the conditions which will bring that kind of early collapse on.
Comprehensive, Colo. I mean, you are in the press box. I think I've said that 3 or 4 times now, but there seems to be this...
Yeah, I work as a cricket journalist.
Noted. There seems to be a huge emphasis on copy and conversation publications about the two themes of abusing people and drinking when it comes to this Ashes series. Yeah. I mean, is there any sense, at least from your end, that it's getting a little bit tiresome or just getting boring? That's this sort of incessant focus on talking about the way people behave or socialise off the field or the things that people say on it? Or is it kind of justified? Are these real themes when it comes to elements that influence the Ashes?
Well, they're definitely influencing and dominating the conversation, aren't they? And I think that's a product of just greater scrutiny, especially with the on-field stuff. Not a lot that gets said isn't transmitted through some microphone, some or another. And even though they're not meant to broadcast it, bits and pieces get out. And obviously the famous broke your fucking arm thing a couple of years ago and all the rest, which got that train in motion. Look, I think that with the on-field stuff, there's been enough chatter from both sides to suggest that it's been pretty intense. But, I mean, this isn't stuff that cricketers aren't used to. We all know, having played plenty of cricket, that this is kind of regrettably, you know, puerile chat is just part of it. Now, I'm not saying it's justifiable, but I think the scrutiny is there. And I think that some players, you know, would be far more aware of what they're saying now compared to I've been a generation ago. As for, you know, the sort of culture of drinking alongside cricket, again, like it's championed and celebrated when teams are doing well. Remember 4 years ago when Australia won the Ashes at this ground in Perth, indeed. They brought beers into the change rooms. George Mark Taylor Bailey, was there singing True Blue. It was George Bailey was the only one that could open the beer. That was sort of a humorous anecdote at the end of that test match. But, I mean, you know, there's no one cares when you're winning. No one minds that Chris Rogers, when he rocked up late for that press opportunity after the Sydney test match, skipping out on the tiles all night, naturally. No one minded so much then. But when you've lost a couple of test matches, these things tend to be magnified. So it's probably just being street smart. The funniest thing, I think, out of it all, was that they went back to the same bar in Perth. The Duckett thing happened in the same joint that the Bear Stay thing happened in, a joint called the Avenue in Claremont. Now, I don't know what's going on there, but, I mean, to think they would go back to the same place, it's just asking for it, really.
That's just what English people do when they're in Australia. That's what English people do. Backpackers, they just go to the same bar. Maybe they got a chop there. Keep going back there two, three nights a week.
Hang on, Australians just go to the walkabout, don't they?
I mean, it could very well be the case that they go back there again. I mean, if they win the test match here, I really hope they go to the Avenue. I know I will be. If they win here, I'll be going to the Avenue and I'll be taking a photograph at the front of it, in the same way that the embargo in Bristol becomes a tourist destination into the future. Yeah, sure, it was a pretty brutal thing that Ben Stokes did, but tell me no one, if you go to Bristol now and you're a cricket person, you've got to get your photo taken at the front of embargo.
Oh, absolutely.
It's going to be a thing. I'm going to make it a thing.
Business ideas, sightseeing. Colo, thanks very much for that rundown on the Perth test. You are in the press box, so I really do appreciate that insight. It's a bullish Colo this morning, which I very much appreciate.
I'm tired. Mostly I'm exhausted, and I just want to go home. And I can't go home because I don't even know where I live anymore. Yeah. I have no fixed address. It's a weird life that I'm leading at the moment. But you know, it's always a pleasure to talk to you blokes and your very enthusiastic audience. Oh, by the way, I should tell you blokes that the other day a question came up to me on a podcast, a political podcast actually, that I was doing. They asked me what the most recent book I read was, and I got to tell it in great detail that it was The Grade Cricketer, Tea and No Sympathy. And I thought I should relay that to you, that now there's going to be a whole bunch of Labor Party hacks I'm searching around on Amazon to work out what this book about Chop King is about.
There's parallels.
Can't wait to look at those analytics.
There's parallels without doubt.
Factionals.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I can see, yeah, I mean, every faction's got an Uggsy, I suppose, mate.
Who's Das Jari in the book?
He might have a bit of time to do some reading now. I might flick it over to him.
Thanks very much, Colo. Didn't think we'd crowbar a Das Jari reference in there, but we did. And I guess we'll catch you next time.
Thanks,
you
mate.
Will. Be nice to him. Talk to you soon. Cheers.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks, Colo.
But hang on a second. There's been some breaking news, and the Grade Cricketer, as always, first to respond to this breaking news, or in other words, have been scrolling Twitter. And obviously, when there's been breaking news in the cricket, there's only one man to turn to, and that is the man we just spoke to, Adam Collins. We've called him back. He's scurried into a box somewhere, and he's got a couple of things to tell us. Colo, what have we got?
Yeah, sorry, I'm breaking news. Only one thing that the press box loves more than champing people, it's breaking news. The England 11, which I speculated on before, I was completely wrong. Joe Root won't be batting 3 and Johnny Bairstow won't be batting 4 and Ben Stokes won't be playing. It'll be the same 11. How boring is that? But it'll be with Bairstow and Moeen switching spots. That'll mean that Johnny will now bat 6 and Moeen Ali will bat 7. So not the most revelatory news. I think we vaguely thought they probably would go conservative with the same 11. But there it is. You can broadcast the truth rather than my speculation from before.
Yeah, no worries. I mean, I think most people listening to this will probably have the cricket on right now anyway, and we'll be telling them things they already know. But just a quick reaction to that. I mean, as much as it's not exactly the changes that you were plumping for, Colo, and they're changes that I would agree with as well, I suppose there's a it still sort of reeks of common sense in its own way. I mean, Bairstow's a better batter than Moeen, and they want to give him more of a go and get him up there facing the good bowlers and give him more time to make some runs.
Yeah, both made four centuries in 2016, so both can clearly bat. But look, more my concern at the moment is whether Moeen can hold up and then with the ball. I think his batting will come good at some stage. His class, especially when he's had the chance to bat down the list a little bit. But it's with the ball that I think at the moment there might be a couple of questions for him to still answer, which is partly due to the fact that he's had a poor preparation, side strain in the lead-up. He injured his finger in the first test match, cut it there. So he's struggling to get any meaningful penetration or spin on the ball. And that's in stark contrast to Nathan Lyon, of course, who's out-bowled him comprehensively. So, look, they're going to have a lot of work to do, the England seamers, especially if the track's rubbish. And as for Bairstow, look, his class, you know, which is clear to see as a match winner from 2016. He's batted with the tail here. He's been routinely left with the tail, actually, batting number seven. Every innings he's played, he's had to bat with guys down the list. He's given an opportunity to flourish in the top six. It's where he made a bunch of his runs, was batting in his position last year as well. So I think it's a sensible change. You know, I still think there's merit in giving him a chance to bat in the top four, because at his best, Bairstow is one of the best players on the planet. But all the same, if you're going to make a tweak, that's the logical small one to make. And now it's kind of up to Moeen with the ball, I think, to justify his worth. Obviously, he's a must-select for this England side, but I'm not entirely convinced that it's going to be sustainable for them to not make a change to their spin department. Having said that, they've only got Mason Crane on tour. So Mason Crane's the young leg spinner they've brought out because he played back in your league, played club cricket in Sydney last year. He impressed a few people. He had Stuart McGill as his coach there. He got himself into playing for the New South Wales side by the end of the season, the first foreigner to do that for a couple of decades at least. So I think they would have been reticent to have used him on debut in Perth. That sort of adds up to a nasty conclusion if they gave that a run. But at this stage, I think Moeen's their best and only bet. They've got to find a way to make it work.
Well, the great cricketer responsive to the media cycle as ever. More specifically and accurately, Adam Collins, thanks for being on the line to give us the up-to-date insight that we also desperately crave.
Yeah, my absolute pleasure, Sam. I'll talk to you soon.
Cricket for results. I don't come to take wickets, score runs, or win games. I play cricket to look good. Rigs, chests, pipes, circuits, salads. This is my domain. So when I hit the sheds, I need to radiate success. That's why I use Chop King Cologne by TGC. With a blend of the finest handcrafted English willow and Kookaburra Red King leather, Chop King Cologne lets me radiate cricket. Whatever the ground, whatever the circuit. Chop King Cologne. The new fragrance for men by TGC. Reek of runs without hitting them.
All right, guys, I'm not sure if our next guest could be more removed from the sphere of Australian club cricket as this man is, and I really genuinely mean that as a compliment. And we always start with the numbers, so, because that's all we are, so let's do it. 115 tests, 7,728 runs, 16 test tons, captaining his country throughout the 90s. He was England's most prized wicket for a decade. He's easily the most esteemed cricketer, current or former, that we've ever had on the show. I'm giddy talking. I don't think I've ever actually been nervous for a guest, but I am today. I'm, of course, talking about Mike Atherton, who I read. And I read this, Athers, you're listening to this wild, long introduction. You're a metropolitan...
I'm blocking.
you're a metropolitan sophisticate, apparently, comfortable in your role as journalist and broadcaster, living well in Notting Hill, and can often be seen out dining with Stephen Fry or fellow former cricketers. So, Athers, welcome to the great cricketer.
Who wrote that nonsense?
Can I just ask to kick off, as someone who dines with Stephen...
I'm a humble northern working class lad, but go on, crack on.
You know, not that you need to be worried about this, but I'm genuinely bewildered as to why you agreed to chat with us. Why are you here?
Two words, Gideon Haig, that's it, really. He emailed me and said, they're a bunch of good lads, will you help them out? And really, when Gideon asks you, it's hard to say no. I've known him a long time. He's been a good mate for a long time, often comes and stays with me when the Ashes are on in England, and vice versa. I'll be hoping to see him in Melbourne over Christmas. I mean, you know, I've seen him during the series anyway, so it's really him. I couldn't say no to Gideon. Nothing to do with you lot. Don't know who you are, so down to Gideon.
That'll definitely you, be a soundbite on this show. I was going to ask about your career, but actually, can you just tell us about what, like, breakfast with Gideon Haig looks like? I mean, I'd imagine you two just sitting there with reams of broadsheets around and other classical texts. I mean, what do you talk about?
Well, he's great. I mean, I've known him a long time, as I say, from about, I think we first met in 1993 up at Old Trafford. I think that was one of the first Ashes series that he covered in England. And this rather scrawny, scruffy chap came and introduced himself to me in the pavilion at Old Trafford. And he hasn't changed at all. He's still scruffy and scrawny, but of course he's been a brilliant writer over the years, and I've always admired his stuff. And we've become good mates, and, you know, happy for him to come and stay. He often comes with his family over to the Ashes, and it's great to have him when he comes.
Athers, I'm going to Athers. I just slipped out. I apologise, Mr. Michael Atherton. But I want to start this conversation by talking about your playing days. And you grew up playing in the Lancashire Cheshire League. I think I'm right in saying at about 13, 14. That was sort of your first experience playing against men. What sort of experiences were those? And was it, you know, sort of eye opening in a lot of ways?
Yeah, well, I mean, you guys obviously from your role within you know, club cricket in Australia would know all about it, really. Very similar up north. The Lancashire Cheshire League wasn't quite the top tier league, so back then Lancashire League was the kind of most famous league where all the great professionals went, you know, the great West Indian players down the years, and then others. And then there was a league called the Central Lancashire League, which was perhaps one notch down, and then my league, the Lancashire and Cheshire League, was one notch down still. So it was about like the third best league around. And as you say, I got into my club side's first 11 at 14. My first game actually was against a team called Thornham, and they had, I don't know whether you remember this chap, Roy Gilchrist, who's a great famous West Indian fast bowler. And he must have been about 48 by then, but you know, he was Roy Gilchrist and that's all you knew. And I got one straight in the mouth from him early on. No helmets, of course, in those days. So it was a really good upbringing, really. It was a combination. I played a lot of schoolboy cricket, obviously at school and, you know, age group teams, but also playing club cricket. My team was called Woodhouses, playing club cricket against men. You kind of grew up quickly. So that combination was a good one, and that was certainly an opener against Roy Gilchrist when I was 14.
Well, Athers, we actually talked with Mark Butcher last week, and he talked about his own experiences playing grade cricket in South Melbourne, which is actually quite common, as I'm sure you know, for young aspiring English guys to go through the harsh environment of Australian grade cricket and shape you as the man you inevitably are, both on and off the field. But your own path to the Test team was through public school upbringing, then the uni system, then county, then to England. Roy Gilchrist aside, I'm just wondering what it was like when you first met and encountered Australians on the cricket field and the kind of way of cricket and the way of life, I guess, off the field. And can anything really prepare you for that?
Well, I was effectively 2 months out of university. I mean, it was a bizarre set of circumstances, really, 1989. Border brought his team over, and at the start of that summer I was still at university. I was just about to complete, you know, final year at uni, just had ambitions to kind of get through a degree, get into the Lancashire side in the summer, which would have been July at the end of term, and try and cement a place in the England in the Lancashire team. But it's a really bizarre set of circumstances. There was the Rebel tour, which was organized in the middle of 1989, so the Ashes were lost by about the third test at Old Trafford. And because it was at Old Trafford, and because I had just finished at uni, I was made 12th man, not as a kind of, I wasn't in the squad, but I was just doing fielding 12th man duties. And I was changing. We had three changing rooms at Old Trafford. There was first team, second team, and a kind of little room at the back where the young kids changed. And that's where all the negotiations for the Rebel Tour were going on. So I was sat there as fielding 12th man in this test match, listening to what was going on. So it was clear, you know, there's going to be a big shake-up. and the duly was, and all these players kind of signed for South Africa, so they needed some different faces, new players. I just happened to be getting a few runs, and by the fifth test, I was in at Trent Bridge. And you're right, nothing can really prepare you for it. You're 21, fresh out of uni. My first day in Test cricket at Trent Bridge, Australia were 301 for none at the end of the day. That was Taylor and Mark, I think. And that was my kind of baptism of fire to Test cricket. And my last day in Test cricket against Australia, we got walloped by an innings, and it wasn't much better in between. So the totality of my Ashes experience, I'm afraid.
I think you're being humble there, Athers. I mean, let's talk very quickly about your career, because I know you don't have a lot of time. I mean, we probably have a number of listeners out there who might not remember cricket in the 90s, and bad luck to them, I think, if they're Australian. But what was it like captaining and playing for England throughout your time? I mean, what are your abiding memories?
Well, it was a rough old ride, really. I mean, you know, people look back now at the 90s as a pretty shambolic decade in English cricket. Actually, the stats are marginally better than the 80s, but because in the 80s we were winning the Ashes, you know, the 80s are kind of viewed in a slightly different light in England. Everything in England comes down to the Ashes. And of course, I think I played in seven Ashes series and lost them all. That's another record as well, I think, along with Stewie. So because everything is determined by the Ashes and by Australia, and because we were getting beaten by a very, very fine Australian team, you know, that is the kind of the view that people have of the 90s is a pretty difficult decade. And we were competitive against all the other teams. I think in my time we beat every team in a test series bar Australia, but you know, you're coming up against Australia every other year, and you know, it's a pretty good Australian team, so we struggled.
So, Athers, I'm really fascinated by that West Indies team sort of through the beginning of the 90s and the sort of towards the end of the 90s as well. But I was reading something today, and you were obviously England captain in 94 when Brian Lara hit a world record 375 at Antigua. And Phil Tufnell has been quoted saying that you had said, "Brian's batting well today. He might break the record." at what stage was he on? About 15 when you said that? Like, how flat was that?
Well, I mean, I take most things that Tuffer says with a pinch of salt. I mean, I love him dearly. He's a lovely guy, and we played a lot together. I can't actually remember saying that. I do remember him being in unbelievable nick. I mean, it was a flat pitch. Even I got 100 on that recreational ground pitch. And, you know, we got 600 ourselves. I think it was 600 played, 600 game done. So it was a flat deck. And Brian had the bit between his teeth. And he was in that glory period, really, those two or three years. He got that 277 at Sydney, didn't he? And then he came back to England after the 375 and got 501 for Warwickshire against Durham. So he just, you know, he was right at his peak with an appetite for runs. Brilliant player to watch. I mean, you could almost, even as a captain of the opposition team, you could almost kind of stand there and admire it, really, because it was so beautiful to watch. Great player.
Athers, I read somewhere that you were considered sledge-proof. Where did you develop this trait? Cambridge?
I certainly not Cambridge, no. I mean, that's sledge-proof. I don't know. It's so overplayed, you know.
Come on.
I mean, the Australian team under Alan Border were kind of, you know, they were a fruity bunch, but they'd have a go at you. And if you were fine, you know, they kind of pretty much left you alone. And it's slightly overplayed. And it's actually just looking at, you know, the Ashes series now, all the talk about sledging, you know, before the game, before the series. I don't remember any of that. I remember it being fierce on the field. But I don't remember any of the kind of circus that goes around now, around the matches. It's changed a little bit.
That's really interesting, Athens, because that was my next question. I mean, so much of the media capturing of this Ashes series, we won't spend too much time talking about it, but, you know, seems to be about that social and behavioural dimension and, you know, far less about the actual cricket itself. You know, whether it's off-field behaviour or on-field behaviour, you know, and in the infamous words of Don Trump, you know, on many sides, You know, like, what do you make? I mean, you're in the media now, a huge part of it. What do you make of this media focus? Do you think this is a media-driven thing? Is it justified?
I think it's a reflection on just a number of changes, really. I mean, obviously the media's changed. The whole social media aspect of it means it's voracious, really, and never-ending. And you know, players are much more out there and available now. You know, 2 days before the Brisbane test, I think Australia made 6 of their players available for interview. Now, you know, it's a good thing. In the media game, you can't criticise that. But that's very different to how it was when essentially the captain spoke before and after the game. And that was it, really, way back in the early 90s when I started. So a combination of organisations wanting their players to kind of dominate the media space and the voracious appetite of the media really has given it a whole new dimension. And as England are finding to their cost on this tour, you know, in the post-Ben Stokes world with phone cameras and what have you, you know, you're never off duty. It's very, very different to how it was.
Athers, you actually wrote an article quite a few years ago, and it was, I guess, a controversial piece at the time. It was puncturing the aura of the baggy green. And it's kind of inflated standing. You know, John Howard would attest to how wonderful the baggy green is. And it's kind of something that flows through in society generally. I mean, you know, a common catchphrase is that the second most important job in Australia after the prime ministership is the test captaincy, which I think trivialises a lot of the good things that public servants do. But I'm just wondering, more seriously, what was the kind of broader reaction to that article that you wrote, kind of, I guess, slamming the aura of the baggy green, which is something that Steve Waugh brought in, one of his greatest legacies, some say. And did you actually receive any support from Australian circles on this?
Okay, it's a while ago now. I think I got a frosty look from Justin Langer one day about it.
really?
I mean, basically, the point of the article was really that I thought Australia were a great team in that era because they had great players and they were a better team than we were. And the notion that somehow there was a kind of moral dimension to it didn't particularly see to be the case. They had some, you know, 4 or 5 great players, and you know, they're a great team for that reason.
Just better at cricket. I think that's spot on. Athers, if you do have 2 or 3 minutes, I'm sure there's many listeners out there looking forward to these throwdowns, which obviously you'd have no idea what these are. But would you mind if we just gave you a couple of them? I'm sure you're familiar with the concept of throwdowns.
Go on.
Okay. All right. Mike.
Go on.
Mike, Freddie Flintoff recently stated his belief that the world was flat, or at least bulbous like a turnip. Your careers did overlap, and I was just wondering whether, as you know, as his skipper, you might have offered him some literature, and if so, what would that literature be?
I didn't skipper him, thankfully. We did cross over a little bit. I played in his first test, one of his first tests, when he got a pair. Freddie's a grand lad, but the earth is not flat, and he knows it. What I would offer him, I've no idea, really, but Copernicus or something.
Athers, your autobiography was entitled Opening Up. Now, as a man with an appreciation for the English language, does it hurt that your publishers force you to go with such a lazy pun for the title?
It was a lazy pun. I'm slightly embarrassed looking back at it. But a complete absence of imagination, really, won the day, I'm afraid.
Good sales, though.
Athers, a well-written book. Good sales, well-written. Available in all good bookstores.
Our first book our first book was literally called The Grade Cricketer, so we've probably got nothing on the lazy titles.
Athers, I'm sure you've told this story many times. I'm not so interested in, like, the circumstances surrounding it or why. I know why you did it, but I want to ask you, how good did it feel to declare on Graeme Hick on 98 Not Out?
You're cruel. You're very cruel. I saw Hickey a few weeks ago down in Townsville. He's coaching the Cricket Australia 11, so it was great to see him, and we get on fine. I have to say it was a bad afternoon, and I've said many times that I regretted that decision. I wish I hadn't done it. Wish I could have the time again and make a different decision. but I'm afraid you can't do that.
Athers, you're 185 not out in 643 minutes to salvage a draw against South Africa, one of your trademark innings, obdurate endurance. Will men do anything to avoid spending time with family?
What's he meant to do with that?
Into my second month away from precious family, I better keep quiet, keep still on that one.
I don't know about this question, Athers, but I'll throw it out there.
Who's made up these questions?
Our producers.
Not us. Definitely not us, yeah.
Is this a simple Black one? I'd regret not asking this one, Athers, and I'm sort of sighing thinking about it. Can you just take us into the England tubbing or showering culture in the 90s? Like, did everyone get nude, or was Alan Mullally a board shorts kind of guy?
Was he a what kind of guy?
Bathers, board shorts. I don't know what the phraseology is.
He's a surfy at Big Al. He's from Perth. I don't even know whether he still is in Perth, actually.
Give him a buzz.
A bit of a surfy. He once caught a shark off the coast of East London and put it in my bed, which was the kind of guy he was. Kind of slightly off the wall guy.
He wasn't the answer.
That's the
kind
of guy he was.
Yeah. I'm happy with that. Appers, Shane Warne once said that he'd never read a book in his entire life, which is funny because I've read four on him. If Shane was to one day read a book, do you have any recommendations on where he should start? Don't say Opening Up by Mike Atherton.
What about Gideon's book, On Warne?
Yeah.
Brilliant, short exposition of the genius of Shane Warne. Yeah.
Not Ulysses.
Boys, will that do? I've got to go.
Yeah. Yes.
Banging on with these throwdowns.
That's a love. Alfred at the end, as always. Mike, thank you so much for your time. And we did steal a little bit more than you asked, so apologise for that. But you've been a wonderful guest.
It's been a delight to talk to you, boys.
See you later.
Thanks, mate.
The Great Cricketer. Tea and No Sympathy, put together by Dave Edwards, Sam Perry, Ian Higgins.
One of the most important things about any form of cricket is lying. You know, you have to lie about your batting average. You have to lie about how many runs you scored on the weekends. You have to lie if you drop that catch, if it bounces in front of you. Does that carry? Yeah, definitely carry.
It's a centrepiece of cricket.
And you have to lie to your wife. You know, if there's a bit of drizzle around and the game's been called off on a Friday night, you still pack your kit and you go to the game on Sunday morning because you're going straight on the circuit with the boys.
Yeah. Dog eat dog.
Yeah.
It's Darwinism. Great cricket is basically survival of the fittest.
Yeah. Well, the great experienced club veterans don't exist in great cricket anymore. They're gone.
Club veterans, no, 23 years old.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Second year university.
Still trying to work out their basketball.
Yeah. Finishing his arts degree. Yeah.
Finding your sexuality.
So, just in a line or two, what great cricket's all about.
It's about being very aware that it's just a feudal system. First graders to the top of the land, the kings and the barons of the world. Oh. Peasants are in fifth grade and everyone else is just trying to stay relevant.
Oh, outstanding. I love it.
Thank you very much to Adam Collins again for coming back on this show, and Michael Atherton. That was awesome to speak to Athers, my new best mate, Athers. Ask TJC is coming up in a few moments' time, but just before then, we thought we might try an exercise. This can go really one of two ways. Either one, it's staying on the podcast, or two, it's going to get lost in the edit. But what we thought we might do is, as the loyal listeners will know, Tea and No Sympathy is out in bookstores. Christmas is around the corner. Kris Kringle time, you know, or just buy it for yourself because it's that good. We like to think that somehow I've been promoting this book for months and that was the best pitch I could do. We've said for a while, I'm telling you guys, Sam and Dave, that that we like to think that we can turn to any page in this book and there's something wild and ridiculous going on.
Well, here goes. It was one of our KPIs when we were putting the book together that you should be able to, as the reader, turn to any page, any sentence, read it out, and maybe get a laugh or be confused or just generate some kind of emotional reaction to it, good or bad.
Yep.
And we did set KPIs before writing the book as
we
well.
We did set KPIs.
And we didn't hit any of them except for that one. So we thought we might give you a little bit of flavour of the book. If you haven't, a lot of people will have already read it. And we thank you very much for buying it early. That's very kind of you. And also thanks for the kind words that people have been saying to us. Pez, do you want to say something?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Can I just also That's say right. we're going to do this exercise honestly and live. You know, we're literally going to open the book and put our finger on any page and see what actually comes of it. So,
So hopefully not the bibliography.
Do you want to start, Pez? We've all got closed books in front of us. Yeah. Do you want to turn to? We're just going to turn to any page. Is that the idea?
Yep.
All right. Well, Pez, do you want to start?
Okay. Yep. So I'm just picking my copy of Tea No Sympathy up $29.99 for a grand. I've opened the book. I've put my finger down. Here's what I've got. Go to the first sentence. Polished wooden floorboards gave way to carefully placed furniture, including the centerpiece of his room, a king-sized four-poster bed with six symmetrically placed pillows, the mattress covered by a designer quilt with silk edging. To face out from his bed was to be exposed to 180-degree views of the city, a remarkable feat given the rough industrial setting this place was in. To face into his bed was not so much surprising as jolting. On the wall at the head of the bed, directly above the pillows, was a life-size poster of Mark Waugh. There he was in 1997, decked out in green Australian Test helmet and Slazenger gear, casually clipping one off his legs in inimitable style, overlooking the room like a Hindu deity. It was then that Nugsy's stories came flooding back to me. He had always made a point of highlighting his love for sex in the missionary position. It occurred to me that this would expose him to Mark Waugh's gaze, were he briefly to raise his head during sexual liaisons.
Just a normal paragraph.
It's a normal paragraph of the book.
So that was from chapter one. That was the first two sentences of the book.
Not that exciting.
No, that wasn't. Dave, do you want to go next?
Yep.
Any page,
so I'm
any
doing
chapter.
This. You can see me. I open it now.
Yes. Yes, he did it.
Yeah.
Yep. Ross McGrath was a self-appointed skipper for the Father's 11, the founder and CEO of a Tier 2 telecommunications company servicing the corporate and government markets. Ross was just one of several high-flying businessmen on our team. This was a private school, after all, and I was playing alongside captains of industry, CEOs, CFOs, COOs, all on 250k plus at the very least. I was just one of three players not currently serving on a company board. I made a mental note to take advantage of these networking opportunities during the lunch break.
I feel like we're allowed to laugh because, you know, I mean I didn't write that chapter, so I mean yeah, I think yeah, that's point. All right. All right, well I'll wrap this up and then we'll hit Ask TGC.
He goes.
What have we got?
Go live.
Yep, I'm doing it. All right. In the safe confines of this vehicle, surrounded by your best mates. All jokes and elbows, the world, and this night is your oyster. Who will we see? Where will we go? Will I get arrested? Will I burgle a chop? To those on the outside, you're just four blokes crammed into a Volkswagen Polo, being incredibly rude to a bloke who's merely trying to earn a second income to support his young family. I'll give you 5 stars if you give me 5 stars, Nugsy bellowed through the window as he slammed the door shut, a little harder than he probably should have.
Uber policy, 5 stars for 5 stars.
The rich world
Tea
of grain cricket.
No sympathy. Mm. It's in all good bookstores. You know where to get it. If you write to us asking where to get it, you're wasting your time. You could have put that into Google. All right. Hashtag Ask TGC, gentlemen, to wrap up this. Another most wonderful show. Will Laurie writes in and he says, what is the grade cricketer's thoughts on Triple J moving the hottest 100 countdown to a Saturday, given most competitions are played on a Saturday, excluding tens of thousands of drunks from listening? This just adds to the list of reasons to loathe cricket on a hot January day. A little context for the listeners as to what Will is asking us is that the Triple J Hottest 100 Countdown happens every year on Australia Day. This year, Australia Day is on a Friday, but during the controversy surrounding the history of Australia Day, Triple J have decided to put it on a Saturday the following day and not on Australia Day for the first time. So what are our thoughts, Dave and Sam?
Yeah, only a grade cricketer would see the moving of the Triple J Hottest 100 day, which I fully support and view it as wild discrimination against him. You know, that is the ultimate bubble of grade cricket. It might be slightly sensitive to our indigenous population, but now I have to play cricket and I can't listen to it. That's so unfair.
I think like the Triple J audience is obviously skewing younger and younger, a lot like the grade cricket demographic. I mean, I haven't listened to Triple J in years, so I guess a lot of the young grade cricketers would be interested to find out, you know, where Peking Dunk is ranking or whoever is making music these days. I'm only a 32-year-old man, but I feel really out of the music loop these days. That's just me, though.
All right. Matt Sampson, I actually enjoyed this question. He said, because I don't enjoy most of them. Yeah. I study at a prestigious UK university that I'm reliably told is the poor man's equivalent of Sydney Uni, which, much like great cricket, it operates a feudal system where the tutor, i.e. selection committee, is the near sole arbiter of one's progress. Despite having worked under mine for 4 years, he still doesn't know my name and looks over my shoulder whenever I attempt to make deferential eye contact. I've tried almost everything to gain rapport, including offering the customary bribes and sexual favours. Mm. That took a dark twist. I also happen to play a bit of uni seconds. Recently, I've contemplated inviting him to winter nets so that he might view my above-average levers, forward press and cover drive while I take apart the medium-pace net. Is this likely to be an effective way of gaining rapport? Further, is the fact that I'm 28 and the median age of the team is 19 a sign of my ascension upon the social hierarchy, or yet another sad reminder that I still haven't made any meaningful progress in life?
Man, there could be some dad issues there, I think. Like, there seems to be a lot of desperation to win the favour, although I suppose there's sexual favours as well, but... there's a lot of desperation to win the favor of this guy. It's a sad state of affairs when trying to win favor. You think, well, maybe I can impress him with cover driving medium paces in winter nets.
So there's a single person, like, and he's called him a tutor. So this guy is vested with absolute power over his cricketing destiny. Is that right? Because so their selection committee is just comprised of this one individual, and he's been there for years and years. He still doesn't know his name. All the rapport he's tried to build with him is just flatly refused. His only option is to leave the club, quit university, and go play for another club. Because when you leave a club, you have a chance of reinventing yourself. If I could move clubs every week, I would.
I thought he was actually trying to like get better uni marks. I thought it was university related, and he's just taking him to the nets to his own environment to try and win favour. So basically, it's like having a tutor at uni and going, in order to impress them, I'm going to invite them to the nets and cover drive medium paces.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, okay.
That's right. But
understood.
But I think Dave's point still, I think that still stands. I think you can still change universities.
Well, I need to listen to these questions a little closely, more closely next time. And maybe read them.
I was interested
them.
That the that he's including customary bribes and sexual favours. I don't know what customary sexual favours include, Matt, but perhaps you want to write back and let us know, or not. James Walker says, "Hey, boys, love the content and the podcast especially. Just a quick question. Does the revelation that Andrew Flintoff is a bigot and believes that the world is flat take away from the idea that the ideal model of a cricketer is Flintoff 05 #AskTGC. So James wants to know, does the aura surrounding Flintoff 05 and everything that represents, has that been diminished by him being a flat earther like Kyrie Irving?
No, quite the opposite. I think it's right on brand. I mean, everybody knows that the very best sports people are usually pretty thick. So like, that's almost kind of a prerequisite, isn't it? I don't really want to name names or just completely ensure that Shane Warne never comes on this show, but it's just one of the prerequisites, isn't it? Like, there's a couple of classes of player. Like, I've actually always one day wanted to write an article about, like, the shit bloke versus good bloke 11 of Australian cricket, and I'm sure that the shit bloke 11 would win. I'm sure.
Oh, no doubt. I haven't actually heard this about Flintoff, but it makes complete sense that he's a flat earther. He's from like the sea ball hit ball way of thinking and life. I mean, he did everything hard and aggressively, and that obviously extends to his views on physics and science in general. Just dismisses it as absolute dross. Just smashes it for six with his massive levers. Science.
I walk on the earth, it's flat. The earth must be flat. Yeah.
I'm not reading any peer reviewed papers on this. Earth looks flat, it's flat. Sea ball hit ball.
Well, I like the art versus science debate when it comes to cricket, and especially Hawkeye, where cricketers will just say, no, but look, it looked out, so therefore must be out. I don't trust technology. Yeah. Ball says missing stumps, but no, looked out, must be out. Don't trust science.
Don't trust science. Fake news, Trump.
See Earth, here.
Kale Volatakis says, hi, chaps. A girls in cricket ad has been on the telly recently. One girl says in the ad, my dad encourages me. Porkies or a different dynamic because of the father-daughter bonds? Thoughts and cheers. Very good question, Kale.
Short question. Right to be suspicious. I'd say, oh, I haven't got that ad over here, but right to be suspicious and right to... Kale, right to see that ad and immediately think, oh, I must write this to the great cricketer guys for their thoughts.
This ad.
If there's any fathers out there of girls that can talk us through the father-daughter bond, we'd be very interested to hear that, and especially how that can relate to cricket as well. I mean, how early can you give your daughter throwdowns? I mean, those are the kind of questions we want to know.
Okay, chaps. Jordan Powell has won this week's question of the week because it's an absolute belter. He says, dear TGC, I have found the holy grail in a Kent-based, cricket-loving Australian girlfriend. However, I have recently stumbled across a potentially major issue. Her dad has asked me to play for his Sunday cricket team next Sunday in the English countryside. What concerns me is the post-match shower situation. How can I look my potential father-in-law in the eye ever again if he has seen the triumvirate of my possibly illegal bowling action, sloppy rig, and almost exactly average package? Should I chub up for the showers in an attempt to show him that his daughter is having an enjoyable, if not entirely satisfying time, and approach the shower situation with enthusiastic vigour, but run the risk of outfitting the man on his own territory? Should I avoid the showers and risk looking like a rare unit and too much of an unsuitably unhygienic man for his youngest daughter? Or should I shower with trunks on and keep my eyes locked firmly above chest level, accepting my position as the beta male? Please help, because I'm worried that potentially outplaying him on the day and dominating the shower scenario may be taken as an attempt to usurp him as the sole and alpha male of his family, and I'm currently cannot afford to lose his blessing.
Why do we always finish with the one that makes me question why we do this?
This is almost like what it must be like as a guest to receive throwdowns, where just all of the jokes were already in there and there's nothing more to say. I might have to revise the whole thing. I can see the dilemma on the one hand, I'd imagine that a father would like that the son is kind of deferential to him, and so the father can always feel alpha because everyone wants to feel alpha. But on the other hand, there's that kind of deep biological thing where the father wants to know the son can protect the daughter. So I'm not really sure how he does it. I mean, I think give in to the ego and just alpha at all times. Keep it really simple. He's asked you into the cricket field. It's his environment. It's time to step up an alpha, Jordan, I think. Mm-hmm. And he can deal with the problems and the consequences of that.
Oh, Dave, thoughts?
Firstly, mixing cricket and family is fraught with danger. Like, I'm surprised, actually, that he's even considering this offer. But if he is to go ahead with the game, look, I think it is one instance where you can, trunks, as he calls them, in the shower and accept his position as the beta male. Because if I say that, because if he was married to this girl, then I might give different advice, but he's still in the early stages of this relationship, and it really sounds like he doesn't want to mess it up. Like, he's described her as the holy grail, a woman who likes cricket. So if you want to maintain that, then maybe you should bow to your own ego and just put the trunks on and just accept that he's going to think you're a rare unit and just disparage you at every Christmas lunch.
Interesting advice, Dave. Pez, rebuttal?
Oh, it's not so much a rebuttal. Like, Tony Jones in this. In relation to this, like, I'd want to know their finances as well. Like, if the father's in a position to kind of offer money for property, for example, which is a very big element of, like, marrying in. You know, marriage is an economic institution. I know they're not married yet, but it looks like with the Holy Grail they might be. Do you think if he plays better cricket and has a bigger penis than the dad, that the father's more likely to give money financially for property? Or do you think it would be better if he had a smaller penis and a lower average than his dad? I'm not sure.
Depends what the deposit is for the house.
That's a good point. But I wonder if in this situation, actual hand size is more important than penis size, like, because the handshake is more important than, you know, what it's like to be in the showers. What's the age? You know, is the dad in his, you know, 60s, you know, early 70s? Is that more likely? You know, in which case it's going to be just everything's going to be a disheveled mess.
I mean, what's for sure is Jordan's going to be really hoping that her dad doesn't listen to this podcast.
Yeah.
Her dad literally has probably just really convivially invited him to play some cricket as a gesture of welcome to the family. And all that's happened in response is Jordan freaking out about his dick size.
Yeah.
And whether he should alpha him.
Yeah. Nothing would make me happier than if a dad listens to this podcast. And nothing would make me happier.
And he gives his perspective on it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Please write in.
Get them both on. How'd the game go, Jordan? Yeah.
Okay. So it's been the highs and lows. I mean, somehow in this same episode, we spoke to Michael Atherton and we finished about talking about Jordan's situation in the showers. Thanks to Colo. Thanks to Athers. Thanks to Sam Perry. Thanks to Dave Edwards. My name's Ian Higgins. I'll see you next week.